This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 51 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. Today's programme is an extra episode and is a feature on the museums of the three UK military arms: the Museum of Army Flying, the Fleet Air Arm Museum, and the RAF Museum. We're playing the three features in the order we recorded them, and I first spoke to Susan Lindsay, the curator of the Museum of Army Flying. Our second feature is with Dave Morris, the curator of the Fleet Air Arm Museum. And our final featured segment is with David Keane, Access Development Manager for the RAF Museum. We asked all three to explain the history of flying in their organisation, describe the museum, and finally give us a taster for what aircraft and exhibits they're displaying. Now that's all the talking from me. Let's get to our first feature with the Museum of Army Flying.
Hello, my name is Susan Lindsay and I'm the curator here at the Museum of Army Flying.
Susan, let's start then by talking about the history of flight with the Army. Where did it all start?
Well, it actually started quite a long time ago, back in the 1860s. They had started using captive balloons in military operations in wars such as the American Civil War, and they had proven themselves to be quite useful. And a very forward-looking group of army officers decided to start undertaking trials using balloons for military purposes at their own expense, which I think was great of them. Yeah. And eventually the whole idea was picked up by the authorities, and in 1878 they established an organisation at the Woolwich Arsenal, whose purpose really was to develop military ballooning for the British Army.
Right, okay. So how did that then evolve, and what sort of trials and tribulations did they have making that work?
I think they had all sorts of trials and tribulations. When they first started using them operationally, there were technical difficulties to do with the fact that at that point they couldn't compress gas.
Right.
So in order for you to operate in places like the Sudan, they actually had to build a gas production plant at Suakim, which obviously made the balloons very immobile.
Yeah.
And also the technology they were using to build the balloons was fairly simple. We're very used to synthetic materials, but these early captive balloons were actually made of a thing called gold beater skin, which is actually ox intestines.
Right, okay. And then how did that evolve into, I suppose, gliding and more powered flight?
Well, they went through, if you like, several stages in between. In 1906, the Royal Engineers adopted an amazing contraption called the man-lifting kite, and that was designed by Samuel Cody. But it was, in effect, the beginning of using wings, if you like, to gain height. And the advantage of that was that you could use it in high winds when you couldn't use balloons.
Yeah.
And then once the internal combustion engine had come along, they could build airships. And then after the first powered flight in 1908, the Royal Engineers also then began to use aeroplanes as we would understand them.
Right, OK. So let's talk a little bit about powered flight and some of the early gliders. What was the Army's role? Did it see the aircraft as a vehicle, as a weapon, or as an observation platform?
That's a really good question. As so often, I think, happens in aviation, the authorities were actually quite slow to pick up on the potential.
Yeah.
But there were individuals who had great vision, and one of them was a gentleman called Bertram Dixon, who used an aeroplane for aerial observations during manoeuvres in order to plot the positions of armies on the ground.
Right.
And initially this was considered to be bad form, but of course actually he could foresee how aeroplanes were going to be used, certainly at the beginning of the First World War.
Yeah, reconnaissance as we now know it. I love the statement seen as bad form, but you know, in good British humour I can sort of understand that. But of course it's now evolved, and moving into, I suppose, early flight and the First World War, the army had a very strong role there, didn't it?
It had a tremendously strong role, and I think the First World War was just a tremendous catalyst for change.
Yeah.
There was big technological change, but also a revolution in how pilots were trained and also how aeroplanes were being used. They started off in the very traditional role of reconnaissance and observation, but by the end of the war they were being used for bombing and strafing in ways that we are much more familiar with in terms of aerial warfare.
Yeah, and so what aircraft were the army using in the First World War?
Well, initially they were using quite simple aircraft like RE-8s. Towards the end, they were using much more sophisticated aircraft, like, for example, the Sopwith Camel, that was actually acting as a much more powerful weapons platform.
So how did the army maintain its identity and its role in flight through the First World War?
Well, in some respects, in quite basic ways, the cap badge for the Royal Flying Corps was based on that for the Royal Engineers. The uniforms for the Royal Flying Corps were khaki. The rank structure was the same.
Was the Royal Flying Corps an element of the army?
Absolutely, and it drew its membership from various regiments.
Right.
There are fantastic stories about inspectors who would be looking at airfields on the Western Front,
yeah,
and they would arrive to find the various air crews still wearing a very motley collection of army uniforms from a wide range of different regiments, because all of these men had actually retained their own sense of identity from the unit they originally signed up to.
And the army's a very regimental organisation, and no doubt was a lot more back then. How did those pilots and mechanics and observers maintain that identity in this very new and technologically advanced organisation that was evolving?
I think actually in many respects they created their own sense of identity. Airfields on the Western Front would have been established on what could sometimes be very rough farmland. They were relatively isolated, although some of them might have been equipped with lorries. And therefore they become in effect quite an isolated community that develops very much its own character and its own way of doing things.
So the First World War really saw the establishment of the army and the use of aviation for reconnaissance and other purposes. What happened then between the wars? And how did the army's role there evolve?
Well, between the wars, army aviation support was provided through army cooperation squadrons. And they, from 1937, used the Westland Lysander for things like artillery observation and movement of people and such like.
Okay, and then moving into the Second World War, of course, a much greater role. But by that time, we had the Royal Air Force as well, that was established in its own right. How did the army maintain its presence in the air?
Well, actually, in the Second World War, the story of army aviation splits into two quite different threads. And the first one is the Air Observation Post Squadrons. And they were really born out of the shortfalls of the Army Cooperation Squadrons. And they focused on artillery spotting. And one of the problems that had occurred with the Army Cooperation Squadrons was that they were using Lysanders that were relatively slow, not very well armed, were quite an easy target for an enemy fighter.
Yeah.
And also they were being piloted by RAF pilots who didn't perhaps fully understand the requirements of artillery gun crews.
Right.
And a group of officers suggested an alternative way of doing artillery fire control that involved very light aircraft, two-way radios, and critically, pilots that were Royal Artillery officers.
Yeah.
And when their trials proved to be successful, they established the first Air Observation Post Squadron, which was 651. And that was formed in 1941, and it became one of 16 Air OP squadrons that served in all the theatres throughout the Second World War, and actually ended up doing quite a broad range of activities.
Right, okay. And the Army's role then in terms of strike was taken over by the RAF and the Navy. And of course, the evolution of flight saw rotorcraft coming in. How did the Army sort of capitalise on vertical takeoff?
Well, they did do trials with hoverfly helicopters, but there were certain technical problems that made them unworkable. They were difficult to get spares, and they were quite difficult to maintain in the field. The Army really embraced helicopters when they formed a unit called the Joint Experimental Helicopter Unit, and that was actually based here at Middle Wallop.
Yeah.
And that had Sycamores and Whirlwinds. And that was undertaken a number of different trials to see exactly how effective helicopters could be. There were still fairly big question marks over how useful they were until the Suez Crisis in 1956, when it was decided to use some of those helicopters from Middle Wallop on board HMS Ocean. And they were used to land Royal Marine Commandos from the ship onto shore. And in 89 minutes, they imagined they were able to actually land something in the region of 425 men and 23 tons of stores. And really, that one incident was the thing that really proved the value of helicopters to the Army and paved the way for rotary wing in the military.
So how did the Army Air Corps come about?
Well, the Army Air Corps came about in 1957. And it was an amalgamation of the personnel from the Air Observation Post Squadrons and the Glider Pilot Regiment that had been the other thread of Army aviation in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And they were combined to undertake reconnaissance, casualty evacuation, activities such as that using relatively light aircraft.
Okay, and let me go back then and ask about the gliders. A major role, particularly in the Second World War, and I've just walked past all the wonderful books and stories, and I'm desperate to go and buy a few to reread them. There are some significant events in the war that were affected by the use of gliders and the Army's role there. And you've got some examples of that here in the museum. How influential was the Army in terms of changing some of those elements of the Second World War?
I think it's fair to say that they were critical at certain points, and one could even argue that they were critical actually in the outcome of the war. They were used, if you're unfamiliar with Allied operational gliders, they tend to be a lot larger than people imagine they are. Hmm. The Horsa, which was the workforce, could carry about 28 troops, for example. They were used for carrying large bits of kit and equipment, artillery, to critical points when it was needed as part of airborne assault. One of the most famous ones is obviously their use at D-Day for capturing the bridges over the River Orne and the Cannes Canal. But they were used really to add significant punch when it was required for airborne operations. And they tended to be critical as a precursor for a more large invasion force.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's move on to the modern Army Air Corps, which is predominantly using rotary wing aircraft. And we're at Middle Wallop, where they have a very strong presence. Tell us a little bit about the last couple of decades and the Army's role in flight.
Well, I think the role of the Army Air Corps has changed quite significantly in the last couple of decades. When it was first established, it was involved in fairly traditional roles of Army aviation in terms of reconnaissance and observation and movement of men and materials. But with the Cold War, there became a need for the capacity to have an anti-armour strike element, and that was the point at which missiles started to be fitted to utility helicopters. And really that began to pave the way for the design and procurement of a specially designed combat helicopter.
Right, okay. And of course we've seen particularly the use of the Lynx in events over the last couple of decades and the powerhouse that is. And you've got a special example of that here, which we'll look at later. Where is the Army today then with its flight capability.
I think the Apache gives it a tremendously strong capability. I think the advantage isn't just the firepower associated with it, but it's the mobility. It can operate not just from land, but also from on board ships, as been seen in Libya. Yeah. And that makes it incredibly flexible, and it makes it a very important element of a rapid reaction unit.
Well, let's move on. We're, as we've mentioned a few times, we're at Middle Wallop here today. Let's talk about the museum. How long has the museum been established?
Well, the collection was actually begun in the 1940s at RAF Andover when there was an air observation post unit there. And when that moved to the airfield here at Middle Wallop, it brought the collection with it. And it was moved to various different points around the camp here and then was first opened to the public in 1974. But at that point, it was behind the wire and also the collection had expanded. And it became clear that, in fact, a good new purpose-built museum was required.
Yeah.
And that was built here and opened in 1984. And then we've gone through a period of expansion ever since.
Right, okay. So what can we see here? How's the museum laid out? What have we got to look at?
Well, we cover the story of all the main branches of Army Aviation, right from the Royal Engineers, Royal Flying Corps, through the Second World War and right up to the Army Air Corps. We've got in the region of 40 aircraft, and that ranges from a very simple First World War Sopwith Pup right up to the Lynx Tow. But we've also got a really good collection of smaller artifacts, and they are really good at communicating exactly how these aircraft have been used on active operations and also the stories of individuals as well.
Yeah, okay. And the museum is on an active airfield. It is at Middle Wallop. You can also see a fair amount of flying activity as well, can't you? So coming down to visit the museum can be linked to a little bit of plane spotting and photography.
It can indeed. We have Apaches here. We also have squirrels. And if you use the hashtag MAF movements, you can stay up to date with what the latest flight movements are, and you can see what's going on at the airfield prior to your visit.
Right. Well, I'm going to pop out later and see what I can see. Did I see a UH-1 departing a short while ago?
You could well have done.
I felt the car shaking and looked up to see a UH-1, so that was quite impressive. But Susan, let's go and have a look at some of the exhibits you've got in the exhibition.
Great.
So, Susan, we're now out in the museum itself. Tell us about the earliest aircraft that you have here.
The earliest aircraft we have is the Sopwith Pup, which was actually introduced for the Royal Flying Corps in December 1916. It wasn't officially called a pup. That was a pet name that was used by pilots at the time and stuck, really. It was a very popular aircraft, was particularly good at being manoeuvrable at altitude.
So, Susan, tell us a little bit more about the Pup and it and its performance and it and its capabilities and also the role that it played in the First World War.
Well, it was designed to be a fighting scout, as it were, which means that it's a single-seater aircraft. It was able to operate from quite rough, rudimentary airfields. It's fitted with the Vickers machine gun, and the particular Pup that we have still has its interrupter gear, which was the mechanism that allowed the pilot to fire the Vickers through the arc of the propeller without actually damaging the propeller blades.
Yeah, and it's quite amazing standing here in front of this aircraft. I almost feel the atmosphere around it. The information that we've got as well that helps us understand a bit more, I'm quite amazed by its ceiling. 17,000 feet this thing could get to. Goodness me.
Absolutely. Obviously, that pushed the capacity of the pilot himself to the limit.
Yeah.
Because obviously he's operating in very hostile environments. Even when it was superseded by the Camel, it still retained that edge for manoeuvrability at altitude.
Yeah, okay. And how successful was it? I mean, obviously, we see success as shooting down other aircraft as well as its reconnaissance role. Was it successful as a fighter?
I think it was successful as a fighter. Certainly, it inspired fear in enemy pilots when they first spotted it. I think one of the significant things is that although it was introduced in December 1916, it was superseded in 1917. And I think that that's a really clear indicator of the rate of technological change that's occurring during the war.
Yeah, rapid. But there were a lot of them built. 1,800 of these aircraft were built. And again, you know, some of the stats on it are really quite amazing. I didn't know it had a four-hour endurance or anything. So I'm learning a lot by being here.
Well, that's fantastic. It was an immensely popular aircraft, and even when it came out of service, it was still used for training and was even acquired by individuals as a private runaround.
Right, okay. And the way that the aircraft are laid out in the museum, you get a little bit of a feel for its environment as well. That makes it feel a lot more real than, I suppose, just an exhibit in a plain environment.
That's one of the things that we're quite keen to do, to actually show how we feel that the aircraft would have looked when it was being used, for example, in this case, on the Western Front. Because we do think that adds to people's understanding.
Yeah, okay. And what else do we have around the aircraft? I noticed some shells and some other bits and pieces. Is that a refueling Bowser there?
It is indeed. A very simple device. That is a refueling Bowser.
Gosh, it was really simple in those days. And the other thing that one takes from the aircraft is how small it is. You know, it isn't quite as big as I thought it was, and throwing this around the skies must have been quite something.
Really quite incredible, and I think the whole feeling of flight at that time in aircraft like this must have been very immediate.
Yeah.
There is nothing between you and the environment you're flying in, and that must have felt very real.
Yeah, and this airframe as well, what's its history?
Well, this was actually used by the Royal Naval Air Service over the Western Front.
Right. Wow. And Susan, one of my favourite stories from all your exhibits is the story about the shell that was apparently caught at 8,000 feet in mid-trajectory. Tell us a little bit about that story and if it's true or not.
Well, in the showcase here, we have a German anti-aircraft shell case. And the story goes that it was ascending into the sky and was actually caught at about 8,000 feet in August 1916 by a member of an air crew in an open cockpit.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're not quite sure whether or not that's a true story, but it's a great story.
It is a great story, and if you want to see that shell, it is here just in front of the Sopwith pub. So, Susan, we've moved around now from the very earliest aircraft to one of the more modern aircraft, and we're in front of the pre-production Lynx aircraft. Tell me about this, because it's very special.
This is an incredibly interesting aircraft. During the flight trials that it undertook, it became clear that it could be a potential record breaker, and therefore non-essential kit was stripped out of it, and in 1972 it completed a series of circuits at just under 200 miles an hour. That meant that it actually broke the world record at the time. Interestingly enough, it's also the first British helicopter to have completed a barrel roll. And obviously it's capable of doing that due to the revolutionary design of the rotor head on the Lynx.
And this aircraft, or this aircraft type, is currently in service, and it's being superseded by the Lynx Wildcat at the moment. But there's still a few of the Mark 8s, I think, still in operation.
Certainly, the Army, I think, have still got a few Mark 9s.
Mark 9s.
Yes,
Mark 9s.
Absolutely.
Corrected. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Now, this airframe that is in the museum is here. We can go inside it. You can have a look inside.
You can, indeed.
So you can see the cockpit. You can get a feel for the size of this aircraft. And again, even though it doesn't matter how many of these I've seen, it's really big and it takes up a lot of space. So it's a great exhibit. It's in Army Air Corps colours, and it is the record-breaking airframe, so well worth having a look at.
Absolutely, it's one of our most popular exhibits.
Yeah. And what developments did the Lynx go through to evolve through its service in the last couple of decades?
Well, the Lynx has very much evolved to meet the needs of the Army. It started off as a utility helicopter, but as the requirements changed, it became fitted with GPMGs, and then ultimately with the TOW missile system to give it a very strong anti-armour role.
Yeah, and it's got a unique sound, the Lynx, hasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's to do with that unique rotor head.
So we're in the centre of the museum now, Susan, and we're surrounded by aircraft of various types. Directly in front of me is the Gazelle. Tell us a little bit about some of the other aircraft in here.
Well, we have in front of us the Sycamore, and this was actually used in the Suez landings and therefore is actually a very important
helicopter. This particular airframe?
This particular airframe.
Right,
was.
Okay.
So that's very exciting at that very birth of using rotary craft by the Army. Above it, we see a Scout fitted with SS-11 missiles, and that really is the beginning of the armed role for British Army helicopters, first used against enemy positions in the Falklands War.
Right.
As we move around, we have an Alouette. They were purchased by the Army Air Corps during development difficulties with the Scout. And then we have the Tiny Skeeter, and this was the first light helicopter that came into service with the Army in 1958, was underpowered. If you look at it, it doesn't really look like a helicopter as we would understand it today. But it did prove the value of using rotary craft as observation platforms.
Right, okay. And there are some other exhibits as well to keep some of the younger members of the visitors occupied as well. And just to wrap around 360 degrees, we talked about observation and the history of reconnaissance. What aircraft types have we got at the back there?
At the back we have the EP-9. That wasn't adopted formally by the Army, but it was trialled as a replacement for the Oster before the Beaver was taken on. Next to that we have a Cessna Bird Dog that was used during the Korean War, and suspended from the ceiling we see an Oster Mark 6.
So we've come into the second hall, Susan. A lot more aircraft again in here. Just give us a quick wrap around of what we can see here.
Well, this is the Hayward Hall, and this is where we hold our collection of every Allied glider used operationally in the Second World War. So we can see the Hamilcar, the Hadrian, the Hotspur, which was used for training, as well as the Hawser that was used on many operations. We also have a Huey that was captured by 656 Squadron in the Falklands, a trainer aircraft called the Chipmunk, and just beyond that you can see the Lynx Mark 7.
So for anyone who's really interested in the history of flight, there's a great deal in here as well. And the size of some of these gliders, they're massive.
They are massive. The Hamilcar, of which we have a substantial fuselage section, would have originally had a wingspan of 110 feet. It was used for carrying fuel, ammunition, vehicles, but it was so large that it could even carry a 7-ton Tetrarch tank.
So, Susan, it's also about history and it's also about heritage. We're in front of a display cabinet here with a uniform. Tell me whose uniform it is and why it's so important.
This is the uniform of Staff Sergeant Stanley Pearson. And Stanley was a glider pilot during the Second World War. And he was tasked during D-Day to land a platoon of Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry in order to capture the river over... capture a bridge over the River Orne. Normally gliders were set off at a certain weight and then would undergo a series of changing bearings and time at certain bearings in order to gradually descend down onto their target area. The problem with Pearson is that once they cast off, it became very clear that in fact the glider was seriously overloaded, and rather than gently descending at a controlled rate, it began to plummet quite seriously. Now this was made worse because at about 1,000 feet the door was open ready for the troops to come out, and there was a big influx of air which caused the glider to move around. And also it's worth bearing in mind that in gliders the flaps are controlled using bottled air. Now that means there's only a limited amount of time that you can use them. So rather than taking this all organised, pre-planned approach, Pearson decided that really they just had to head straight for the target area and hope for the best. And due to quite extraordinary flying skills, he managed to land the glider exactly where he should have done, right in the middle of a field. And in fact, the troops that he was carrying captured the bridge within minutes. And it's one of those really astounding stories about the skill of glider pilots when it was really needed.
Was he decorated for that?
He was. He received a Distinguished Flying Medal.
So, Susan, we've had a look at some of the key exhibits here, and we've had a walk around. What else is there on the site that people can engage with? You've got a cafe?
We've got a cafe with a balcony that's got an absolutely fantastic view over the airfield, where you can see aircraft movements, take photographs. And we've also got a play park for younger visitors and a 1940s house.
And there are a couple of airframes outside as well. I got one of them wrong, so I get a little slap on the hand for that. But what have we got on the entrance as we come in?
We've got a Scout and a Beaver.
And did I see on the approach from Andover some other aircraft?
You did. There is an Oster on a mound on as you approach the museum.
Right, OK, it was an Oster. We've heard some helicopters about today. It is a working airfield, and it's a great day out. If the weather's not good, you can come inside. If it is good, you can go outside, see the aircraft, take photos and that sort of thing. Susan, remind us then of where we can find out about the museum online.
Well, probably the best place to go is our website, which is www.armyflying.com. But you can also find us on Facebook and follow us at MAF Army Flying on Twitter.
And you love a bit of engagement as well on social media as well, so please do engage with the team here.
Please do, and if you visit the museum, do let us know what you think, bits that you liked, bits that perhaps you don't like, because it helps us to make the museum better.
Yeah, and there's a great shop, a little store at the end. It's got some great books, not only about the army but about flight in general as well. So all round, there's a great amount to do. So Susan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Dave Morris. I'm the curator of aircraft here at the Fleet Air Arm Museum at Yeovilton in Somerset.
Dave, let's go back then to talk about how the Navy got into flight. Where did the Navy get involved?
Good question, and it goes back a long, long way, more than 100 years today, you know, if we take it in that term. The Navy were interested in flying ahead of some of the other services, and quite leading in the field of getting interested in aviation in 1908, 1909, 1910. Kite balloons to start with. They were working with Cody, looking at man lifting kites tethered behind small ships towed into wind, so that they could launch somebody under a series of box kites in like a bosun's chair or a simple basket, effectively to raise the height of the crow's nest, just for better observation, for looking over the horizon, for getting good quality observation at sea. It's not long before they're then experimenting with balloons, tethered balloons, creating their own airships. And then in 1910, 1911, actually getting into looking at fixed wing aircraft proper, things like the Short S-27 box kite, which is basically an improved copy of one of the Wright brothers flyers from the mid 1908-1909 series of aircraft they were building. Shorts began to build them and copy them under license. The Navy began to take an interest in taking aircraft to sea again to extend range of observation, spot for the fleet, just better eyes at sea.
Right, okay. And then we draw up into the First World War and the use of aircraft in aerial combat as well as observation. What role did the Navy have there?
Again, being so advanced with their aircraft experiments and progress with aircraft and flight at sea, immediately protection for ships. They could take fighter planes to sea, couldn't land back on the ships, but you could launch from a ship and do patrol and escort and fighter cover in the immediate area of the ships, useful against Zeppelin attack or large bomber aircraft that the Germans might be patrolling with. Taking reconnaissance float planes to sea, reconnaissance and bomber aircraft, and of course operating from land. A lot of people forget, you see on the news in more recent times, the Navy have been involved out in Afghanistan using Harriers, operating from forward bases in support of ground troops. That was happening in World War One. Many places where the Royal Naval Air Service were operating Sopwith aircraft, variety of aircraft types, Newport, Sopwith, all kinds of airplanes from land bases in France, in the Dardanelles, wherever, taking their aircraft there by ship, deploying them to the forward landing zones, and then aiding troops and support on the ground with naval aircraft. That's been happening for that period of time.
Right, okay. You mentioned the Royal Naval Air Service there. That's the predecessor of the Fleet Air Arm as we know it. How did that evolve between the wars then to become the Fleet Air Arm for in the Second World War?
It was the Royal Naval Air Service, and as a full and long title through World War One, and at the end of World War One, lots of service units and lots of service organisations were beginning to rethink and reorganise and amalgamate, and the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service, both of whom were operated their respective flying branches, were amalgamated to form what we recognise now as the RAF, the Royal Air Force. So there was one flying service effectively at the end of World War One as a result of the amalgamation. That was the RAF. That worked for 15, 20 years up until the end of the 1930s, when it became obvious that actually the Navy does need to operate separately. There's a lot of things that both branches cover well as an amalgamated service, but the Navy really does need to operate separately from ships, doing its own thing, training its pilots in its own way for its own reason. So a split comes at the end of the 1930s, where the Fleet Air Arm is then formed, the flying branch of the Navy. So the Fleet Air Arm form and break away from the RAF. The RAF continue as the Royal Air Force as we know it today, and the Navy gains back its own controlled flying organisation, the Fleet Air Arm, which again exists up to and including today with modern aircraft.
And the Royal Naval Air Service, or the Fleet Air Arm, or whatever form it was instrumental in developing carrier operations as well, wasn't it? And obviously that played such a significant part in that conflict. Where did that start to occur?
Very early on. We go back in that sense to 1910, 1911, and America was doing exactly the same thing. They were experimenting with flying. Eugene Ely was flying from platforms on the front of converted vessels and small ships. We were also doing the same thing. 1910, 1911, we've got Sampson taking off from a platform deck on the front of HMS Hibernia. First time that an aircraft took off from a ship moving at sea. Aircraft had taken off from platform stationary, but the first time it was achieved moving underway at sea was a Royal Naval Air Service aircraft in 1911 with Sampson flying. So if we wind right back to when were aircraft actually being flown from ships and the Navy beginning to really think about taking a ship somewhere with a platform capable of launching and hopefully at some stage being improved and modified enough to do a recovery, rather like Dunning later on. All of that was putting the idea together, putting the technology together, putting all of the experimenting together to start progressing a way of not just taking airplanes to sea, but actually operating them as well. So the carrier really begins back then.
Right. Okay. And the carriers and of course the fleet air arm, as we know in the Second World War, really came to the fore, and we saw the expansion of the fleet air arm in its own right. What do you think were the major events that saw the success of that service during that time?
Golly.
I know. Maybe I should book you out almost, for another day.
You almost can't mention one for fear of leaving one out. Yeah, because I mean, yeah. it's major inputs, like towards the end of the war with the British Pacific Fleet and the carriers on strength there, right the way down to individual pursuits like chasing the Bismarck. I mean, without having Swordfish at sea on strength, to be able to go out and hunt and find the Bismarck. So there wasn't numerous carriers out there in the sense that there was out in the Pacific, but look at the importance of the role. So it's the mobility, I suppose, isn't it, of having the aircraft. What it underlines is the fact that you straight away, by the time you get to World War II and you're able to take 20, 30 maybe airplanes with you can take your airfield effectively and you can float it in any direction you want quickly, effectively, and you can take that many possibilities of air support with you and do something with it. So I think that what it spells out there is just how hugely versatile and useful the aircraft carrier was.
Yeah, and speed also in both ways of being mobile, but speed also was proved not to be the only indicator of success, because you mentioned the Swordfish there, and of course we know many of the successes that it had, but it wasn't a very fast aeroplane, but it provided a level platform to deliver that armament. As we come out of the Second World War, the Navy starts to look at faster aircraft. Post-war then, how did the fleet air arm evolve then?
Carriers, I suppose the carrier doesn't look hugely different between World War II and into the 50s and then even into the 60s. And yes, some of them were even extending their life and their use range. But it's the aircraft, of course, which noticeably changed. We start moving away from the piston and engine aircraft into the fast jet era. And of course, that brings with it a whole new generation of not just the aircraft, but the pilots and the training which needs to go with it. So the whole picture changes, say, between 1946 and maybe 1966.
Yeah,
as a 20-year chunk, carriers, as we all know, don't necessarily just get built overnight, not quite like they were in World War II, although we managed to convert, build or buy in a huge amount of carriers. And that's an interesting point. I think there was something at the end of World War II. I got a feeling, I'd have to check my figures to be sure, but I think Great Britain actually had 50 aircraft carriers at the end of World War II of all sizes and types. Which is remarkable when you think how few we've got in the fleet at the moment. That's going to change. But whether we'll ever see 50 again, I'm not sure.
Dave, then, as jets and speed comes into play, of course, the world changes. We have the Cold War and we see the development of the jet engine and the jet aircraft. We move on, of course, to probably one of the significant changes where the vertical takeoff with the Harrier, of course. But in the meantime, we've also seen the development of rotorcraft and of course, the Navy is well known for its use of helicopters as well. When did that start to become a real application in the fleet air arm, the use of the helicopter?
If we take the helicopter, and again, I think that would surprise many people to realize just how forward-thinking the Navy was with the thought of using a helicopter, the first proper intended use for helicopters comes at about 1943, 1944, with the Sikorsky hoverfly, or what we would end up calling the hoverfly, being trialed in a joint Anglo-American trials,
right,
off of the ship SS Dagestan, and in New York Harbor, numerous places, between the American Navy, the American Coast Guard Service, and the British Royal Navy. There was a joint trials, right, taking place there, because they could see immediately the benefit of the helicopter for fast response, for search and rescue, for ferrying equipment and supplies between ships. The Navy could spot this and were keen to be involved. So if we think about the start point again, it's as early as 1943. Immediately post-World War II, Westlands, only 7 miles down the road from us here at Yeovilton, Westlands are beginning to build, yeah, helicopters for the Navy. And it's at that point that the helicopter really starts to become an aeroplane or an aircraft type that people recognize in service. So late 1940s, only 4 or 5 years after World War II, the Navy are buying helicopters in significant numbers and beginning to train to, yeah, use them from carriers.
And it's become a real game changer, particularly through the Cold War and into the 70s and 80s. The use of the helicopters, as I walked in, the Lynxes were were operating on the airfield here. Where do you see the role of the helicopter, I suppose, evolving a little bit further for the fleet air arm? Do you see that platform continues to add value?
Absolutely. I can't see it not being used, as long as there's naval fighting ships, yeah, going to sea. The helicopter is so important and such a useful link between the ships of the fleet. Most small ships are now capable of taking a Lynx. Previously it was a Wasp, and now that's a Lynx. And the work that they can do, whether it's actually anti-submarine work, hunter-killer work with air-to-sea,
yeah,
armament, or whether it's support and supplies, or whether it's humanitarian aid, somewhere in the world there's a ship with a helicopter on the back of it, able to carry out that kind of input and support, or all the way up to the bigger carriers with what would have been Seaking, now being taken over by the Augusta 101, again being built here locally at Westlands. That's going to continue easily into another 25, 30 years plus into the future.
Yeah.
And whatever new design comes after that, the helicopter is such a useful piece of equipment.
Yeah,
as a designer, it's here to stay, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course the museum has a fantastic selection of helicopters as well, and we'll see a few of those in a minute. Let's then talk a little bit about the museum. We're here on the airbase, next to the airbase, Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, HMS Heron. We're just outside the gates here, so anyone who does want to visit the museum, they get to often see an active Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm Air Station as well at work. But what's the history of the museum?
The history of the museum starts back as a building, as a collection, as a door to open to say come into the museum. That's in 1964. And immediately prior to that, 2 or 3 years before, in the early 1960s, a group of naval engineering officers were gathering together some redundant airframes on this air station and held in other air stations around the southwest of England, mostly as training aids for students joining the Navy and being able to show them interesting different types of aircraft, airframe, engine technology, with a bit of a history attached to them, and beginning to use them not just for that technical training aspect, but to also start to demonstrate to those new students coming in some of the history of flying in the Royal Navy. It was also at a time where people used to stop on the A303, the main route road down through to the southwest of England. People would often break their journey naturally right at a car parking spot, here at Yeovilton, and watch activities on the airfield. There was always flying available to see, whether it was Vixens, Seahawks, Scimitars, Gannets, whatever happened to be flying in and out. People loved to stop and see the flying. And they began to park some of those collected airframes near a hangar which we affectionately call 12 Hangar. Still exists today. It's the central hangar part of our museum. It's very much part of our makeup. But that hangar had some spare space outside of it. They'd parked the aircraft there so that people breaking their journey not only could see the flying on the airfield, but could see one or two slightly more historic airframes parked next to 12 Hangar. The natural progression was for the air station to allow the engineering officers to start parking the aircraft inside 12 Hangar. And at that point, that's pretty much where the museum was born. And people were able then, I think you paid sixpence, and you were allowed to go in and see the collection. And it's grown from strength to strength. Here we are now, 50 years plus
on.
Biggest
naval museum in Europe, is it?
As a naval collection, yes. And we're not the biggest aviation museum in Europe. No, that wouldn't be correct. But as a naval collection, we certainly are. And if we, think we've got 102 aircraft in the collection now. I think there was something like five or six back in 1964, so it's growing from strength to strength. Yeah.
Okay, so how's it laid out? How are those 100 aircraft laid out in the museum? What's the structure of the museum?
Well, not all 102 are on display. Our museum isn't quite big enough to take the whole collection on display. We've got four main exhibition halls, and we aim to keep approximately 50% of the collection on display at any one time. We're very lucky also that on the other side of the road, just north of our site, but connected by sort of towway, trackway for the aircraft, we've got a very important reserve collection hangar, which we were very lucky to get Heritage Lottery support to enable us to build that hangar. So we can keep the entire collection on site, split between the reserve store and the museum exhibition halls. And having that working link between the two does mean that we're able to exchange the exhibits much more frequently than we ever used to be able to before.
And each of the halls has a theme as well, doesn't it?
It does. We've mostly got World War One story and usually some topical exhibition space in our Hall 1. Hall 2 tends to be predominantly World War Two through to the Korean era. Hall 3 is our carrier flight deck. It's very difficult to tell the full story of the fleet air arm without an aircraft carrier.
You have to come and visit to see that.
So we thought, okay, how are we going to tell the story of the fleet air arm without an aircraft carrier? Why don't we turn one of our entire hangars into an aircraft carrier? So we've given up the entire hangar space to a representative flight deck and a ship's island, and the ship's island is very important, the carrier island. You can walk through that whole island. It's three decks high, and it represents all of the different sections and units and compartments that you would see in a carrier island. So that helps us explain why naval flying is different to our air flying or any other service flying. And that's a very, very important tool. As well as being an interesting exhibition hall, it's a really important tool to help us explain what happens on a flight deck. And then Hall 4 is more our Hall of Flight Technology. We have got Concorde 002 on site.
I'll have to ask a question, but
I know what you're going to say. What on earth's that got to do with the Royal Navy? It's a really good question. Nothing is the is the answer to that, except that the aircraft itself, 002 Concorde, finished its flight trials in 1976. It'd been built in 1969, first flown in 1969, and the government, it was a national decision, it couldn't be scrapped. It was such an iconic piece of British engineering that our first British prototype to fly, 002, could not be scrapped. So it was given to the nation as a heritage item and given to the Science Museum, who own it today. It's here, but it belongs in ownership to the Science Museum in London. But what are they going to do with it in 1976? There's no way they're going to take it into South Kensington. They don't have a satellite airfield capable of, or even a satellite museum or exhibit capable of taking a Concorde. The Fleet Air Arm Museum was fairly well established by then. it had an active airfield long enough to take a Concorde.
So she landed, did fly
she
in.
She flew in. It's the only way you're going to get her in is to fly her in. She came from Fairford on a last flight only. Undercarriage down. They wouldn't even permit the undercarriage to be retracted just in case there was a sign. So she made a short hop from Fairford down to Yeovilton, arrived here in 1976 because we were an established aviation museum. We had a runway long enough to take her.
Yeah.
We had a growing footprint that was going to look suitable for her into the future, and that's how we ended up.
Is it not also fair to say that this part of the country, and obviously Bristol and the southwest, was very influential in the development of the aircraft? So I think it's fair to say that it sort of is in its home territory.
It fell very much back in its home territory. That was partly luck, partly by design. And yes, we've often, and that's part of what we tell in that hall, I think that's an important thing to mention. We often recognize that many of the aircraft types that you will see in there, much of the technology you'll see in that exhibition hall alongside Concorde, all happened largely in a line drawn south of Reading. Yes, if you were to draw a line on the map across the bottom of London, south side of London, Kingston-on-Thames, across to Reading, across to most of the southern part of England, a huge amount of the technology that's generated out of that is what we're displaying in that hall. And I think people are often surprised when they stop and think just how important the southwest of England has been and still is for aircraft development.
Well, Dave, let's go and have a look at some of the aircraft on show.
Sure.
Barry Swordfish. The string bag, as it was affectionately called. This 150-knot open cockpit two-seater biplane was obsolescent at birth, but never lived. Some people were astonished that such a museum piece should ever be in the front line. But it flew through desert sandstorms, and it flew through Arctic blizzards.
So, Dave, we're into Hall 1, and we talked about the very early aircraft here. What have we got on site here?
Well, straight away in front of us, we've got what we were talking about, that very first fixed-wing aircraft the Navy were using. If we look at this aircraft in front of us, this short Brothers S-27 box kite, 60-foot wingspan, cream calico-coloured fabric. What there is of it, but most of it, as you can see, is just struts and endless wire and turnbuckles and bracing
condition.
Wires. It's a replica. It isn't an original, sadly. There's no original S-27s that I know that exist, but it's a very accurate replica to full size. And if you're looking at something with a 60-foot wingspan and 45 feet long, this would have been flying from the front of a ship like HMS Hibernia or Africa, and pretty precarious flying.
I was going to say, you needed some cojones for this, didn't you?
Oh, yes, definitely. Delicate, easy to break, easy to flip over. This was not an easy airplane to fly by any means, and not fast either. I mean, the takeoff speed was something around 35 miles per hour. The maximum forward flying speed in flight was something around 45 miles an hour, so you're not actually flying that much faster than your takeoff speed.
No, and as we look around the hall, we've got a Sopwith and some other things, but you've also got one of your special exhibitions as well. What have you got behind us here?
We have. It's our search and rescue exhibition, which went into position this year. As 2015 is the 100th anniversary year of the first use of an aircraft for search and rescue. And if you swing back around, you picked up on the Sopwith Pup. It wasn't a Sopwith Pup, but very similar to that, a little Newport 12 aircraft, similar size, similar construction, similar sort of technology. Richard Bell Davis, Royal Naval Air Service pilot in 1915, actually performed the first use of an aircraft to do a search and rescue pickup from the field with one of his fellow airmen, which he achieved a VC for. And we have the VC on display here as well.
Wow.
So our search and rescue story starts that far back in this hall and comes around. We've got a Walrus there, Supermarine Walrus, very, very important aircraft for search and rescue activities through World War II. Next in line, we were talking earlier about how early the helicopter arrives on the scene. Well, we're standing in front of Westland Dragonfly Mark One, and this actual airplane was number one off the production line.
Wow.
From Westlands, okay, to the Royal Navy. So a really significant airplane to have here. And then that continues the theme of helicopters down through the hall there. We've got a Whirlwind, a Wessex 5, and then our Seeking Mark 5 at the end. And that's very appropriate in this year as well. Another reason why we chose this year to do the search and rescue exhibition is because the Sea King is coming out of service.
Yeah.
After 40 years plus of service with the Royal Navy, we see the end of the Sea King and the arrival of the new Westland Augusta 101.
Catapults became new accelerators, which meant that carriers no longer had to go careering off into the wind to fly off their planes.
So, Dave, which hall are we in now?
This is our hall two, and this is, as we mentioned before, predominantly World War II era aircraft. The beginning of the hall does include Swordfish and Fairey Fulmar. Interesting to note there, the Fulmar's unique. No other Fulmar's left in the world. Indeed, we've got 15 aircraft in the collection, which I believe are truly unique. You won't see them anywhere else.
I didn't know that. It was that high.
Yeah, it's an interestingly high number of completely unique and interesting airplanes from that point of view. Even amid the 102 in total. So 1939, 1940 period at the start of the hall, and then it progresses through to aircraft like the Corsair here, the Martlet, Hellcat, Avenger, and then finishes up at the far end of the hall with our Sea Fury and a MiG. We've got a MiG-15. That's not an original Korean MiG-15. That's a Polish one painted to represent, but it tells part of that important story where the Sea Fury was beginning to be outclassed by the jet era and the arrival of the jet age, but still holding its own as a very, very fast and very powerful piston engine aircraft. But we're seeing the beginning of the end for the piston era. And here we're standing in front of our Goodyear-built Chancehawk Corsair. And I've stopped us here for a very good reason, because this is somewhere I'm trying to take the collection whilst I'm here as the curator of aircraft. I'm very keen that we deal with originality in the museum and in the collection, and I've frustrated for many years to see far too many objects perhaps painted without thought. There's room to have airplanes painted, there's room to have motor cars or trains or whatever painted in collections, but I think keeping some things in very, very original condition is both important, and it's something that perhaps not everybody stops to think to do, and we've started to look at that more carefully with our collection. So the Corsair you see here was painted in the 1960s, not necessarily as accurately as we all would have liked, but done for all good intents and reasons.
Yeah.
And we began to notice back in around the year 2000 that paint was beginning to flake away. And the more tests and experiments we did, we began to notice and become convinced that actually underneath that 1960s paint was what we began to hope and think was the original paint scheme.
Yeah.
Well, in between our other museum work, which there's a lot to do with only three of us in the engineering department to keep 100 plus airplanes in good fettle, but in between our museum work, we did a concentrated effort on this to pick and peel and scrape all of the paint from the entire airplane away just to see what was underneath. And a miracle, she is in completely original condition. So the airplane we see here, we're looking at 1944. We haven't mimicked that or created that or distressed it to make it look like 1944. We've just uncovered and exposed that from what was painted over.
It's amazing.
There's been an HMS Eagle in the Royal Navy for nearly 400 years. The mighty carrier with its 40 aircraft is the 15th. Sea Vixens, Buccaneers, Gannets, and the recently added Phantoms, which are on trial, plus Wessex helicopters, comprise her aerial strength. She's an up-to-date ship in every way, with a crew of 2,750 who say there's none better.
So, Dave, we've come into the restoration area. You can see this restoration area from the museum, but we're inside. There's lots of pieces around me. What am I seeing come together here?
Believe it or not, this is actually a fairy barracuda under build here. The fairy barracuda torpedo dive bomber is a very important and key part of the World War II Fleet Air Arm aircraft story.
Yeah.
Successor to the Swordfish and the Albacore as far as anti-submarine and torpedo aircraft is concerned. More than 2,500 Barracudas were built for the Royal Navy in World War II, more than any other airplane that's ever been ordered for the British Royal Navy.
Yeah.
And yet not a single example survives anywhere today.
It's a very sad thing to see, really, isn't it?
It is. And long before I came here at the museum, the museum was collecting components from crash sites, correctly given the correct authority to access crash sites,
yeah,
under MOD permission, and bring large lumps of wreckage back to the collection. I'm just fortunate enough that myself and my team that are in the engineering division at the moment here are the ones which we can move that project finally forward with some significance. So we're starting to see all of these components here being straightened out, assessed, and where possible, put back into the build. Now, we've got about three or four different crash sites worth of wreckage to choose from.
Right.
So we've got a lot of material, but there's a huge amount of work to do. And we are determined to reuse as much of the original material as possible, which is why you look at this, what looks like a debris field inside our workshop here at the moment. But it all makes sense to us. And work is moving forward. And again, it's on our website. You can follow progress on several forums and websites, and certainly in a sense become connected and even involved in small ways with the Barracuda project.
Yeah, and we hope to come back and have a talk to you about this specifically, but I think most people will understand my connection to the Barracuda, and I can see the shape of the aircraft in the front. It is a unique aircraft. Some people said it were, some would say it was ugly, but it was certainly unique, and it's amazing to see the work that you're doing here. It's not just about displaying the full airframes that you have, it's about restoration as well.
It is, and again, I sort of apologize that it doesn't look much like an airplane here at the moment, but
yeah,
it is taking shape by the day, by the week, by the month. And you're absolutely right, people can come and actually enjoy watching that spectacle through our glazed,
yeah,
viewing area into the workshop, so people can actually stand and watch the build in progress. And we're very happy to engage with and talk to people about what we're doing here.
Dave, thank you very much for that very quick whistle-stop tour of some of the aircraft. I think nobody would be disappointed in coming to the museum in terms of the heritage and breadth of aircraft on and exhibits on display. How can we find out a bit more about the museum online?
Website. I think website is key these days. Whatever we need, our first stop is click, isn't it? Click on the website. So Fleet Air Arm Museum, anybody that's looking for the Fleet Air Arm Museum at Yeovilton, look at our official website. You will see the museum frontage, you'll see our Concorde, it'll be clear who we are. Twitters, Facebooks, all the social media, we've got links with everything that's out there, so hopefully we're very easy to find on the web to start finding out exactly what events we've got on, checking the opening times. During the winter months we do close Mondays and Tuesdays,
right,
but the rest of the week we're open, and the rest of the year we're open, so it's always worth a double check just to check your timings. We wouldn't want people to arrive and be disappointed, but if you come on a day when we are open, and hopefully we've got a full day for everybody to enjoy, restaurant facilities, often able to see flying on the air station when that's happening.
Little play area for the youngsters as well.
Absolutely, play area there. Lots of outside space as well. Hopefully we are a full family day out for anybody that's thinking of coming to see us.
Yeah, I'd certainly say if you're interested in taking your time around this museum, it is a full day. Well, Dave, thank you very much for hosting us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. they form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Hi, I'm David Keane, and I run the Access and Learning Department here at the Royal Air Force Museum.
David, so how did the RAF come about? Was it from Trenchard onwards?
Well, the foundations of the RAF go way back beyond that. We can go back to the late 19th century when the Royal Engineers of the British Army established the Army Balloon School, the idea being that you could get a man in a balloon tethered to the ground, get him up high, and he could see a lot further than anyone could on the ground. From that, we had the development later of the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service, both of which came into being in 1912, sharing a common central flying school based at Upavon in Wiltshire.
Right.
And the Royal Flying Corps, obviously controlled by the generals in the army, the Royal Naval Air Service by the admirals of the navy. And things proceeded quite well like that throughout most of the First World War, but during the latter stages of the First World War, General Jan Christian Smuts, a South African statesman and general, was asked to form a committee and to report on the future of air services, whether it should continue as part of the army and part of the navy or something different. And the Smuts report in 1917 recommended the formation of the world's first independent air force, the Royal Air Force, which came into being under the command of Trenchard on the 1st of April 1918.
Right, and he had some pretty strong views on how it should operate. How is the and how was the RAF structured back in those days?
Well, he was the Chief of Air Staff, the first Chief of Air Staff. As you say, he did have some strong views on how it should be. But immediately it had been formed, or soon after it had been formed, to put it that way, the First World War came to an end. And the horrendous casualties of that war encouraged all the politicians and others to think, well, we're never going to do that again, so do we need any more armed forces? And in particular, do we need this new infant Royal Air Force? What Trenchard did was point out a couple of things. That firstly, that the RAF could exist as a small, highly professional, well-trained core force, which could be capable of rapid expansion in time of crisis.
Yeah.
And it could also, by being an expeditionary force, it's always taken the fight to the enemy, always acted, not reacted. And he pointed out that in the early 20s, it could police areas in which the United Kingdom had significant interests. The northwest frontier of India, for example, and the Middle East. So our first involvement in the troubled country of Iraq came in the 1920s when it was policed from the air by the Royal Air Force.
Right, okay. So how was the Royal Air Force then evolved into the organisation that we know and see and love today? Its structure, its hierarchy, how did that form?
As it went on, the hierarchy became obvious as what should happen. So by the middle of the 1930s, it was fairly obvious that despite the efforts of the peacemakers, there was likely to be another war and it would again be centred on Europe. The RAF was then structured into various commands, and perhaps the most famous is Fighter Command, of course responsible for the air defence of London and the Battle of Britain and so on, and Bomber Command, which from the first day of the war to the last took the fight to the enemy and for most of the war was the only means by which the Allies could hit at Germany. Mustn't also forget, of course, the role played by the other commands, Coastal Command, which assisted the Royal Navy, I suppose, in maintaining Britain's lifeline. Winston Churchill said that the only thing that had really frightened him in the war was that we might lose the Battle of the Atlantic, because, of course, most of Britain's food, all of its fuel, came across the sea. And the Royal Navy did that, protected the merchant navy's convoys, bringing the supplies into Britain, absolutely vital. But the Royal Air Force did as well, and Coastal Command, travelling far out across the ocean with aircraft like the Sunderland flying boat, which we can see here at the Royal Air Force Museum at Hendon, maintained the security of those convoys and ensured that Britain's lifeline was never cut.
Right, okay. So their functional structures, how did the squadron structure come about, and how has that, I suppose, filtered through to what we recognise today?
Well, I think the origins of the squadron are to be found in the cavalry, and that's quite interesting because the First World War emphasised that with the churned up ground and the trenches and the barbed wire, that the cavalry as we consider it, horses and so on, just couldn't operate. But the cavalry of the clouds, the Air Force, could. So it was a worthy successor, if you like. So the squadron is the basic unit, and that's the airman's home, if you like.
Right.
What he regards as his regiment, that's where he starts. The squadrons were divided into flights, and the flights were divided into sections. So there was a variety between squadrons in fighter command, for example, and squadrons in bomber command. But that's the basic kind of structure, and your first loyalty is to your squadron.
Right, okay. So after the Second World War and events there, what changes did the RAF see as it went into, I suppose, what we recognise as the Cold War years now?
Again, massive changes. Once more, it was a decision to downsize the armed forces, and the Royal Air Force had to regroup, re-equip, and take note of things like jet engines coming into play. So in the post-war period, it was visualised it would be a jet force. And from the end of Second World War right through to 1969, the Royal Air Force maintained Britain's nuclear deterrent with the V force of bombers, that's the Victor, the Valiant and the Vulcan bomber, capable of carrying conventional or nuclear weapons and being kept at quick reaction alert at airfields in Britain, but with the capability of taking off within 4 minutes, that being the time estimated to detect an incoming Soviet missile attack.
Yeah.
So throughout that period of the Cold War, it was recognised that the Royal Air Force would be able to respond before missiles struck the ground in Britain and would already be on their way with nuclear weapons to deliver to Warsaw Pact and Soviet targets. The first major incident of the Cold War, of course, was 1948, the Berlin airlift. And again, the RAF was crucially involved in that. It was almost as if no sooner had it stopped dropping bombs on Berlin than it was delivering food. But you'll remember that the Soviet dictator, Joseph Stalin, wanted to force the other Allied powers out of the former German capital of Berlin, despite the agreement that all the powers should have a presence there. And he did this by closing off all land access, so no road or rail links were maintained to Berlin. But there were three air corridors which couldn't be closed, and for 15 months the population of West Berlin, which otherwise would have starved and forced the Allies to leave, was sustained by round-the-clock flights from Western Germany. Tremendous operation. Yeah. Very logistically important, difficult to achieve, but it was maintained. The Russians at that point gave up, and although it was never that easy to get into Berlin, it was always a bit of a palaver, a bit of a struggle, it was never impossible, and the Allies, the French, the British and the Americans were able to maintain a presence in Berlin until the Berlin Wall came down in 1989.
Right, we've seen a lot of change, of course, in the last decade or so, with the Cold War ending and a whole new world opening up. The RAF is still a frontline force for Britain. How has the RAF fared over the last decade or two?
Well, the RAF has always embraced technological change. It's always been forward-looking, and that's as true today as it has been in the past. Nowadays, things are more complex, and of course, processes are much more rapid, information technology and so on, which has made a huge difference. But with the introduction of aircraft like the American-built F-35, with British technology, a lot of British technology in that, including, as far as we're concerned, Rolls-Royce engines, the Royal Air Force is maintaining its position, capable of seeing to the air defence of Britain. And we've had examples of that in recent years, with the Typhoons kept on air defence, so that every time the Russians come near to our airspace just to see if we're going to notice, the answer is yes, we always do. And some Typhoons from RAF Lossiemouth will be scrambled to just go and ask them politely to leave. Similarly, we maintain a detachment of Typhoons in the Falkland Islands, so keeping an eye on our territory in the South Atlantic. And when special events occur, the Olympic Games, for example, the Typhoons were moved, some Typhoons, to RAF Northolt, so that the air defence of London could be covered and that the games would be kept secure, whatever the threat.
Yeah, well, it's very exciting times following the defence review as well for the RAF. But let's talk then about the museum and the RAF museum. And we're in Hendon, but there are two parts to the museum. There's Hendon and Cosford. We're also in a room that doesn't have an aeroplane in it, having this chat. Let's start with the room that we're in. What are we in and what are we seeing here?
Right, well, this is really interesting because this is the first phase of a new development for the museum, which will transform the museum ready to celebrate and commemorate the centenary of the Royal Air Force in 2018. The building we're in was originally constructed in the middle of the First World War by the pioneer who started flying here at the site at Hendon. His name was Claude Graham White, and he built a great aircraft factory here at what is now the site of the museum and indeed much of the surrounding area. This building formerly stood some 400 yards away, but it's been moved wholesale, and it had suffered for many years. It had had a variety of uses and been derelict for at least 20 years. But we had in our possession, in our archive, a 1915 photograph showing the room as it was originally. And in 1915, it was fairly fashionable to hark back to earlier ages and the Tudor period. Wood panelling and refectory-type tables were seen in houses and in offices and so on. And Claude Graham White fitted in with that fashion. So his office had wood panelling and a great Tudor-type table surrounded with chairs and all that sort of thing. And it looked a bit like a Tudor mansion. But from the evidence in that photograph, we've created his office, and it's a pretty good reconstruction.
Yeah, it's the photograph is meticulously copied in this room. It is quite an impressive demonstration of how to recreate a historical place. But let's talk, David, then about the museum. How long has the museum been on this site?
Well, the museum opened on the 15th of November 1972. It was in planning from the 60s onwards, I suppose. So we've been here since 1972 as a museum. The core part of the original museum building is actually two RNAS hangars that were put up in the First World War. But we've expanded beyond that. So we have a hall which is at the moment dedicated to the Battle of Britain, another to bombers, another one which we call Milestones of Flight, which we opened exactly 100 years after Orville Wright first flew, and that was on the 17th of December 1903, so we opened that in 2003. But as I say, this part of the museum that we're in is not only Graham White's office, but also what we call the Graham White Hangar, and that was from his era. It was put up to build a very large bomber, the Handley Page V-1500, which would have been capable of flying from Britain to Berlin and back during the First World War. None were actually built here, and the operation never took place because the war ended first. But we filled that with our First World War collection of aircraft. And when we opened that exhibition, which we did in December of 2014, we looked very carefully at what we were going to be doing and whether the museum needed to change. And the answer was, yes, it did. It was no longer sufficient for us just to be a museum of aeroplanes. That's fine for people like me who like aeroplanes wherever they are. But we recognise that most of our visitors may not have a connection with the Royal Air Force and may not even be interested in flying. So we put lots of personal stories, small objects and other things in there as well to make it engaging with the public. And it's really worked. We've had almost 100% positive feedback on that exhibition. So following that lead, over the next few years, we will transform the whole site. So to make it easier to get around, easier to orientate yourself, a more comfortable place for families. We're taking account of children. And we've also in recent years, again, looked at the kind of people we attract and the ones that we don't and see what we can do to make sure that everyone can share in this history of ours.
It's quite an amazing sight, though. And we have to start with this museum is free.
It's a national museum. Yep. So like the other national museums, yes, it's free to enter. We received a little bit more money from the Ministry of Defence when we abolished our entry charge. And that was the initiative of the Tony Blair government to make national museums free. And we were very happy to go along with that and recognise that it would mean that lots of people would come for a shorter time at the museum.
Yeah.
And we would also get people who otherwise wouldn't have come here at all. And we're very happy to do that. Of course, that has meant greater wear and tear. And we didn't quite get enough money for that. So it's,
no.
we're really interested in people coming, maybe spending a little money in our shop and so on.
Because you raise money through the shop, don't you?
Well, the shop is terrifically important for us. But again, that's something that visitors like from a museum. I do myself when I visit an attraction of this sort. You like to have a shop. We have restaurant facilities, catering and so on. We have a corporate hire team that lets out rooms to people who want to come here for away days or launching products and so on. It's an exciting venue to come to.
Now, let's talk about excitement, because our excitement's driven by those wonderful things called aeroplanes. You've got over 100 aircraft on display here, haven't you?
Yes, we have. And we've got some aeroplanes which you simply can't see anywhere else in the world.
Tell me about one or two of those. We're going to go and have a little walk around in a minute, but tell us about some of the things that are exclusive to this museum here.
Right, yeah, I'm very happy to do that. Well, we have the only wooden-hulled Southampton flying boat here, the only Stranraer flying boat, the Stuka dive bomber, which was very familiar to anyone who's seen any sort of footage from the Second World War. There are no complete ones of those in Europe apart from the one that we have here, and it is one of only two in the world.
And the other one, I believe, is not complete, is it?
Well, there's one in Berlin, which is not complete, and there is another one in Colorado. But if you want to see what one really looks like, you have to come here to Hendon.
Right.
Our collection of First World War aircraft is, I believe, unsurpassed by any other museum in the world.
Yeah.
And the same is true for our ex-Luftwaffe collection. That we have a more comprehensive collection of the aircraft used by the Germans in the Second World War than I think anyone else.
Just before we move on and have a walk around, David, then tell us a little bit about Cosford, because there's two parts to this museum, and we've been very southern-centric, but you've got another museum as well, haven't you?
Yes, indeed we have. That opened originally in 1979. It was our reserve collection, but we said, you know, this is such a fantastic collection, we really ought to have this open to the public as well. So we've done that at Cosford in the West Midlands, and that is an equal collection, similar number of aeroplanes, but quite different in lots of ways. It has more larger aircraft there, the transport collection. But in 2007 we did something very exciting there too, and we opened the National Cold War Exhibition in a stunning building. It's absolutely huge, and it's the first time that the three V bombers have ever been in one building, to our knowledge. They've been on the same airfield but never in the same hangar. But now you can go in there, you can see a Vulcan in the act of taking off, and the Victor and Valiant bombers in there as well. But we're not just aeroplanes, and I suppose that development at Cosford gave us a steer for the First World War exhibition, which opened here at Hendon, and the centenary programme, which we're now engaged upon, because we put in people stories and a lot of the social history. So you'll find not just aeroplanes there, but also the Trabant, the Mini, Volkswagen and so on, which kind of put it all in context, which enables our visitors to react and interact with it and relate to what we're trying to show. We're also aware that it's not just people who are completely able to see and understand what's going on. We get a lot of visitors who have some disability, disabled people, and we've always been very conscious of wheelchair access and so on, and making sure there are no barriers to visual impairment too, so we can do touch tours and so on. And I'm really pleased to say that last year we achieved the Autism Awareness Access Award.
Wow.
So
well done.
Thank you. Yes, we welcome people with autism, when we have put in place facilities to enable them to get as much out of the visit as anyone else. We feel very, very deeply that this collection You know, it's we get proprietorial. I talk about it in my aeroplanes, but we're conscious this belongs to the nation.
Yeah.
They're here for everyone, and we want everyone to be able to come and enjoy them, see them, understand what they mean, and so on.
Well, let's go and have a look.
Yeah, let's do that.
So, David, we've come into the main hall here. What can we see from our vantage point?
Right, we're in the centre of the museum. It's the equivalent of our Trafalgar Square, if you like. And facing us is the very last kind of Spitfire made, the F-24. This particular example was made in 1946, and it's flown for only 7 hours. And that's because by the time that came into service, of course, we were using jet aircraft, so it was obsolete. Beyond that, the Phantom, and that particular Phantom, flew across the Atlantic Ocean faster than anything else in 1969, and that was to celebrate 50 years since Alcock and Brown made the first direct crossing of the Atlantic by aeroplane.
I love the Phantom. I can't say that,
that's a wonderful aeroplane. Next door to it, another fast jet, that's a Tornado, an F3 of 43 Squadron, the Fighting Cocks.
Yep.
So it carries their famous badge and the black and white checker band on its tail, and its Golf Foxtrot, which are the letters always carried by the OC of 43 Squadron.
Right, okay.
And that particular aircraft took part in the first Gulf War. Beyond that, there's a nice, bright, shiny helicopter. It's a Wessex. It's coloured red and blue. It's a little bit more careful than most the average Wessex, because this was the helicopter in which Her Majesty the Queen had her first helicopter flight. It's carried members of the royal family, VIPs, and been piloted by the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Charles, and Prince Andrew. For further helicopters, we have a Whirlwind from the Search and Rescue Force, 22 Squadron.
Yep.
And we've recently acquired, yet to put on display, a Sea King, which will come our way too.
Right.
And we have the ancestor of all helicopters here, an Avro-built version of the Autogyro. Not a helicopter itself, but with a rotary wing, and designed by Juan de Thieva to prove that the rotary wing concept could work.
Okay, and just to put that into context, there's a cafe in front of us as well. You can actually sit here amongst the aircraft, and it's just great.
It is great. You could sit there, you can enjoy your coffee, and you're surrounded by aeroplanes and very often interesting people who come along and talk to you as well.
Yeah.
So it's a lovely place just to sit and relax and absorb the atmosphere.
Yeah, it is. Well, let me wrap around. Just behind me then, we've got a Meteor.
Yes, a Meteor, the only jet to see any significant service in the Second World War, because its Rolls-Royce engines were viable, whereas the German equivalent in the fitted in the Messerschmitt ME-262 weren't. But, yeah, Meteor, a great aircraft of its day, and indeed into the 1950s.
Right.
And then, dominating the entrance to the Bomber Hall, we have our Avro Lancaster, S for sugar. Famous Lancaster, flew at least 137 sorties, and for most of its life flew with 467 Royal Australian Air Force.
Right.
It carried a crew of Australians, and a reminder not only of the tremendous effort put in by the boys of Bomber Command in the Second World War, but also that the Second World War Air Force had contributions from all over the world. Those Commonwealth countries of Canada and Australia, New Zealand, they sent plenty of people to us from Africa, and even from places like the West Indies, where 3,000 Jamaicans joined the Royal Air Force alone out of a tiny population of 2 million. The Lancaster is one of my favourites, and that's because on five occasions in 1944, that was flown by a friend of mine who I met through my work here at the museum.
Wow.
Max Johnson from Murrayfield in Australia. And I forgive him because he nearly destroyed this aeroplane. But coming under attack by Junkers Ju-88 night fighter, he put the Lancaster into a steep twisting turn. The airframe didn't like it very much. Max said he could hear bullets hitting the starboard wing, but in fact it wasn't bullets, it was the rivets popping out. So the aircraft was dismantling itself in the air.
Wow, wow. It is a stunning example. It really, really is. I'd forgotten how good she looked in here. I've got to say. What else have we got in that hall there, David?
Well, alongside it, we have a collection of American bombers, a reminder that of the tremendous American contribution to the European war. The biggest factor of that, of course, was their sending hundreds of thousands of young men to fight. But they also produced an awful lot of aircraft. We have a B-17 and a B-24 and a B-25. So the Liberator bomber, the B-24, for example, being produced faster than they were required, which is a tremendous position to be in if you're fighting a war. And those are reminders, again, of this worldwide contribution in the fight against Nazi Germany. We have a Halifax, which is in very poor condition. It looks a wreck. The wings are both broken, and there are parts missing. This aircraft was lost on its first operation, which was to attack the Tirpitz, that battleship which the Germans had secreted away in a field in Norway. It was hit by anti-aircraft fire and brought down on a frozen lake. The pilot made a wheels-up landing, and the crew largely were unscathed when they got out, so they survived, I'm happy to say. The aircraft burnt itself out, melted a hole in the ice, and stayed underwater for about 30 years. So when we rescued it, we were faced with a bit of a problem. How far do we try and restore this? And the answer to that is, well, if we try and restore it, we'll actually end up by replicating all the bits. So we put it on a bed of shingle and we represent it as in this kind of as-found condition. And actually, that tells a bit of a story itself. So it's one of our most popular exhibits. People like to see it like that.
So we've just come a short way across from the Lancaster. What are we in front of here, David?
Well, in a way, this is the First World War equivalent. Nothing like the size, of course. This is a de Havilland DH-9A, a First World War bomber. And this one actually was brought down behind enemy lines during the First World War. So it was captured by the Germans, and they eventually took it to the Technisches Museum in Berlin, and it was on display there, and it stayed on display there throughout the 20s and 30s, and it was still on display in Berlin in the Second World War. Of course, the Royal Air Force visited Berlin on a number of occasions in the Second World War, and we dropped bombs, and some of our bombs actually damaged our aeroplane. So you'll see alongside it is its American-built Liberty V-12 engine, and one of the camshafts on that has been very badly damaged, the camshaft housing, and that's bombing caused by the Royal Air Force.
She's in lovely condition now, though.
Yes, this is an example of where we have to replicate parts, and what we try to do, as we did with Graham White's office, is use any original bits that we can, and where we can't, we will use parts made of the same sort of material and fashioned in the same way as they were originally. So the wings on this aircraft have been completely fabricated, but it is exactly as they would have been when the aircraft was in service. These early aircraft are all fabric covered, and this particular one we've recovered, and we've done that, I think, with all of our fabric aircraft. But its original side panel is still in the museum in Berlin, and I saw it when I visited there in February of this year.
Wow. Okay, so coming around, we've got some gliders, and tell me a little bit about this lovely silver machine behind
us. This is a very pretty little aeroplane, the frontline fighter of 1930, the Bristol Bulldog. But in concept, not that different, you know, from the aeroplanes which flew in the First World War. It has an air-cooled engine, a fixed undercarriage, and it's still an open cockpit biplane. So by the time we get to 1930, you know, this really was an obsolete aircraft, and certainly no match for the designs which were beginning to be hatched up by aircraft designers in Germany. I think its lack of ability at the time was recognised, because when Sidney Cam introduced the Hawker Hart in 1930, we found that we had a two-seater aeroplane which was some 10 miles an hour faster in level flight than this frontline Bristol Bulldog. So that made the Air Force board think.
It looks very functional, doesn't it?
It does.
It doesn't look very comfortable.
It's going to be drafty in there. And it's really a high-speed version of the stuff that flew in the First World War.
Yeah.
But this one has a story to tell as well. It's featured in a film, and some people will be able to remember that black and white film starring Kenneth Moore, Reach for the Sky, yep. The story of legless ace Douglas Bader, who flew with the Hendon Air Display Team, the forerunners of the Red Arrows, here in the 1930s, and who, on a visit to Woodley Aerodrome near Reading, was persuaded to put on an aerobatic show. And maybe he responded a little unwisely, but in any event, he slightly overdid it, tipped a wing so that its tip caught the ground, and in the ensuing crash, his legs were both so badly damaged they had to be amputated. He was invalided out of the Air Force, but argued his way back in when war came in 1939. He was a pilot of exceptional ability, and fortunately he was taken back in and flew as a distinguished fighter pilot, and we have his wartime logbook here in the museum. And in a way, history repeated itself, for this Bristol Bulldog was still flying in 1964 when being demonstrated at the Farnborough Air Show, and again it crashed. And the aircraft was very badly damaged and stayed in pieces for 35 years or so, during which some of the components were lost. But we display a bit of its original fabric to see the yeah. kind of before and after thing. Well, what we have to start with, there's a little bit of machinery which shows how we've made some of the under-the-skin struts and longerons which form the airframe. But the aircraft now, in its 56 squadron colours, looks delightful.
Is that a Beaufighter I can see at the back
yes,
there?
Yes, it is. Beaufighter, known as Whispering Death in the Southeast Pacific area, where it's it flew against the Japanese. An aeroplane, again, which is, I think, had an undeserved reputation. When it came into service, a lot of pilots found it difficult to fly. And I'm not sure why that is. As far as I know, it really only has the one snag, which is you do have to be careful if an engine loses power, that you just simply mustn't let that wing drop, for if you do, you're not likely to be able to get it back.
Right.
But, you know, Guy Gibson, after he'd led the Dams Raid in 1943, he was ordered to write a book about his experiences. And he wrote Enemy Coast Ahead. And in that book, he tells the story of a squadron of pilots, battle-weary, who were ordered to convert from single-seaters onto bowfighters, and who actually, they refused to do it. They said, we're not going to fly that aeroplane, it's too dangerous. Well, of course, that is a really serious thing to do at any time in the Air Force, to disobey orders, especially in time of war. But fortunately, someone had a bit of imagination as a way of solving that problem. And a Beaufighter appeared at their aerodrome, carried out a series of spectacular aerobatics, then landed, and of course, all the pilots gathered round to see how this was possible. And we're talking about Second World War era, so the pilot was dressed in the leather flying coat and helmet and so on. And when the goggles went up and the helmet came off, then a lot of blonde curls came down, for it was a lady pilot. And, you know, after that, the chaps had no problem in flying the Beaufighter.
So, David, you know an awful lot about what's going on in this museum and some of these airframes in here. Where did your interest in aviation come from?
Do you know, I can't remember a time when I didn't like aeroplanes. And I suppose, like a lot of other people, I'm going to blame Captain W.E. Johns and Biggles. Those books seized my imagination. But aeroplanes are so exciting, even if you don't think you're going to like aeroplanes. Coming here, getting as close as you can, seeing the aircraft, learning their stories. And we've got such a terrific variety here. And remembering, too, that, you know, it isn't just a collection of metal and rubber and perspex and so on, that these aircraft were designed by people, they were built and maintained by people, and they were flown by people. And I think it's that kind of thing which always keeps my interest. I walk through the museum daily, and I'm still excited. I've been here 19 years, and it still excites me. I don't find it boring.
David, thank you very much for that very, very brief tour. We haven't seen a great deal, but thank you for that. Where can we find out more about the museum online?
Well, the thing is, go straight to our website, www.rafmuseum, all one word, .org. And that's an easy website to navigate. It will tell you where you can find out what we have here, our opening times and so on. So that's the first port of call, and that's what most of our visitors and schools that come to visit us, they go to first.
Right, there's podcasts on there, there's a media archive on there, there are games, there are resources. It's quite impressive.
Yes, there's a lot more than just the bare information, but that's there too.
Well, David, thank you very much for having us today.
It's my very great pleasure.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
We hope you enjoyed that brief review and coverage of each of the Forces Air Museums. I really took a great deal from visiting them, and although I've been there many, many times, I can't recommend them enough. I was reminded how fortunate we are in the UK to have the quality of aviation museums and aircraft available to us, and in some instances, access to them is free. We're very lucky indeed. I'd like to thank a few people who made this episode possible. Without their excitement and contribution, we would not have been able to bring you this rather unique episode. Jamie Burrows from the Museum of Army Flying, Mark Farrance at the Fleet Air Arm Museum, and AJ Srivastava of the RAF Museum.
Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to this show. You can now find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKPodcast.com, PodDirectory.com, and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and the use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Look us up on both Twitter and Facebook, that's Aviation Extended, all one word, and we know that many of our listeners don't engage with us here. All I'd like to say to you is that we are regularly putting media material out through these feeds, so if you think sometimes we've missed a story, maybe we're not covering a topic, you might probably have missed us in between episodes. Sadly, we cannot squeeze it all into our programmes. So that's it. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. You can find Tim at RAES Tim R on Twitter and at aerosociety.com. And Gareth is Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and he's at globalaviationresource.com. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from all of us here at the Extended Studio. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.